Tonight's Conversations with Great Minds, I'm joined by Professor Gar Alperovitz. Professor Alperovitz is a historian, political economist, activist, and author. He's currently the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and a former guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of several critically acclaimed books on the atomic bomb and atomic diplomacy, and his articles have appeared in leading American publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Nation Magazine, and the Atlantic. And he's frequently featured guest on major cable news programs. After completing his PhD from Cambridge University, Professor Alperovitz served as a legislative director in both houses of Congress and as a special assistant in the State Department. He's also the president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives and is a founding principal of the Democracy Collaborative, a research institution, focused on initiatives that promote the democratization of wealth. And most recently, he's the author of America Beyond Capitalism, a book that has been described as one of the most important books of the decade. It's my pleasure to welcome Professor Gar Alperovitz.
Delighted to be here. Thanks,
Tom. Glad to have you here with us to Conversations with Great Minds. America Beyond Capitalism, we're talking about systemic changes. What's the system and how does it get changed?
Well, there's a, you know, basically in history, systems are defined by who owns the capital, who owns the wealth. Feudalism, a tiny elite, held the land and the capital. In ordinary capitalism, it was small business owning the capital and defining a competitive capitalist system. State socialism or communism was the state owning the wealth. And we've got basically corporate-dominated capitalism, a system that's not very democratic because, you know, we live in Washington here. The lobbyists are up there swarming and big money's there. Right. But it's a form of capitalism that is increasingly understood, I think both on left and right, as not very democratic. So if you change the system, somebody's got to own that wealth, not only the institutions, but the top 1% now has just about half of the investment capital. Think about that. 1% of a society owning just about half of all the investment capital. That's literally medieval, and I don't mean that rhetorically.
Well, I was going to, in fact, that's where, you know, my mind was going, was like what you're describing is basically a feudal state. It's basically kingdoms. These large corporations are functionally kingdoms with kings and lords and serfs, and they have no loyalty to individual nation states.
Not at all. And not only that, they will escape the nation when they want to, leaving behind empty factories. I've been out to Detroit recently. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a wasteland. They've just left it, or Cleveland, Ohio, or St. Louis. And secondly, you know, I worked on the Hill, both sides, and the lobbying power, the amount of money that's up there moving legislation, and we've just passed this legislation to regulate banks, and there are 2,000 lobbyists up there rigging the rules and finding loopholes. And
Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, and getting what they're having.
And it's still only, what, 20% implemented or something like
That's right.
It's
hardly. Just, But it's what is interesting is that you take the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, they're upset about the 1% owning so much, but they're also upset about the democracy aspect. It's both economic power and economic pain, but also democratization. And in their General Assembly, they're trying to project the kind of different vision of democracy. And it is a vision, but I think it reflects what many people understand, that something's wrong in Washington, something's wrong with this. And that's what's really interesting about this time, when more and more people, left and right, have a sense, you know, there's truly something fundamentally wrong in the country. And, and that's when you know you're beginning to talk about a systemic problem, not just who wins the next election, but really what's wrong at the heart of the system, the economic power base.
Right. Well, there was, I think, this sense all around the world in the 19th century. And in the 1860s, Karl Marx identified the problem, I think, fairly well, actually, in Das Kapital. His solution, you could argue, didn't work out. But that there was a lot of social upheaval that came around that. And then you could argue also that in the 1930s, late 20s, early 1930s, here in the United States and around much of the rest of the world, the Great Depression, there was another crisis of the system. And yet it seems like the system always endures. It always reinvents itself. It always, you know, this kind of neo-feudalism always comes back. How do we break that cycle? And you know, what's at the core of that system, and what's the alternative to it?
Well, there are two questions, or really three. They're wonderful questions. That's what drove me to write America Beyond Capitalism. I think that something at this point in history, and I don't say this lightly, I think this is the most interesting and maybe most important period of our history, and for the following reasons, obviously oversimplified. The economy was decaying in the first quarter of the 20th century, up and down crisis, and World War I bailed out the economy. The economy began to decay in the 20s and then collapsed, and World War II solved the problem. And then in the Korean War, the Cold War, the Vietnam War in the third quarter of the century. And now, you know, military expenditures are high, absolutely, but they're declining to the 4% range. They're not sustaining the economy, and global pressures are undercutting us. So we're really up against, how do you manage the economy
without war, in a way? We ran a war economy for a century.
That's right. I think that's right. And that's like oversimplification. I wouldn't want
to... Go back to after the Civil War. I mean, Reconstruction was hugely profitable.
Absolutely. And kept the system stabilized. Yeah. So I don't think we're in for a big crisis. The economy was... The government was about 11% of the economy in 1929, and it's now about 30%, roughly. So right. I don't think we're going to have a total collapse. But stagnation and decay and pain... And that's when people begin to think, is there a way to rebuild, to try something new over the long haul, trying to change the system, but in more of an evolutionary way than the traditional kind of classic crisis case. So it's a very interesting period. I don't see anything on the horizon that's going to easily bail us out of the stagnation pattern. We'll go up and down, maybe have a ripple. But the pain levels, I think, are going to continue, and that forces people to think, and I think to act differently and hopefully to change.
Well, you said you know the government's about 30% of our economy. And yet, if you look at the economies of Canada, it's about 50%, 53%, right. I believe. Denmark, it's almost 60%. Most of the European countries are in the 50 to 60% range. And you could argue that if we simply took into what they consider the commons, things that should be the commons, arguably, the healthcare system and the higher education system, and maybe a few other pieces around the edge, but those at the core, our government would become maybe 40% of the economy, mm-hmm. and thus the fluctuations in the economy produced by changes in consumer spending would be less.
Right.
Wouldn't that stabilize our economy?
Yes, it's take almost any Keynesian economy, Paul Krugman being the most obvious, yeah. would say just what you've said:
right.
increase the expenditures, invest more. You will get more tax receipts later on to pay for this, and you can run deficits, and you could have a highly performing economy. The problem is politically.
I'm talking about nationalizing the commons, basically.
You are talking about that. And indeed, that way would work.
Right.
But I think the politics of that, I think, is over.
The Koch brothers won't have anything to do with that.
Not only the Koch brothers, they won't play. But one of the things, and again, working in the House and Senate, mm-hmm. That policy, that set of policies, really depended upon a liberal progressive coalition. And that depended upon a strong labor movement.
Yeah.
And labor movement's gone from about 34% of the labor force being organized. It's now at 11% and about 6% in the private sector and declining. So the base of power for that way of solving the problem, sadly, I think is over. So there's either another way forward over the long haul, or I think we're in for real trouble and decay. And decay is what we're seeing.
Right. So what's that way forward?
Well, if systems are organized around who owns the capital, if that's where the power is, and if you don't like state socialism and you don't like corporate capitalism, obviously democratizing capital in some way is the critical idea behind it. Mm-hmm. And it's, in fact, if you think about it, there's a lot of that in America, just below the surface, and the press doesn't cover it. But 140 million Americans are members of co-ops and credit unions. Now
That's almost the size of the American workforce.
That's it, 40% and 40% of the society. So right. people are, they know something personally about a democratized part of the economy. And it's not very fancy, but it is one person, one vote. Or, for instance, there are now something like 14,000 worker-owned companies. I think the last number was 11,000 plus some others. Mm-hmm. And about 13 million people involved in worker-owned companies. Now, that's another way to democratize who owns the wealth.
Aren't a lot of those, though, just kind of the old-fashioned ESOP? By old-fashioned, I mean, these are still recent, the last 30
right.
years or so, but employee stock option plans where the employees own the company in as much as they own stock,
right.
but they really have no say in the company.
Well, that's what's really interesting. Many of those are. There's some other one-person, one-vote co-ops as well. But what's interesting about the ESOP, and we can get technical about it, is it changes the ownership pattern and in most cases hasn't moved to democratization of decision making.
Right.
But there's a trend within the ESOP movement now. For instance, if you go to Ohio, which has been most studied, as people get more shares, not surprisingly, they begin to want more action, wanted more decision making. And you're also seeing some unionization. So I think, and again, I'm a historian, I think of decades going forward, I think we're going to see that whole movement of the ESOP even moving forward towards more democratization, more control, taking over, some of it unionized. There's a movement within, but it's a very interesting developmental pattern that the press hasn't been covering.
As a historian, do you see parallels between this and the Grange movement in the late 19th century? I mean, this was farmers getting together and saying, okay, the big banks in New York are gaming the system, the production companies are gaming the system, we need to organize ourselves into... These were not unions, these were cooperatives.
These were cooperatives,
massive,
yes.
And this was huge in the United States.
And I think there are parallels, and also parallels in the patterns of building up over time. When you think about the New Deal, for instance, most of the New Deal was developed in these small experiments in states around the country. I mean, Justice Brandeis called them the laboratories of democracy. Yeah. But they, in fact, state by state, were doing labor law, they were doing pension law, they were doing safety law. That built up those principles, small scale. When the moment came, they were just the same principles that became large scale at the national level. And I think that's the kind of way to think about these co-ops and worker-owned companies. There are 2,000 municipal utilities, another way to change and democratize. 25% of American electricity today, 25% is either, it's socialized, if you like, municipal utilities or co-ops. Yeah. So there are things on the ground that when you actually dig it, and that's what America Beyond Capitalism attempted to do, just report on this, and then say, what does that look like? It doesn't look like corporate capitalism if you extend the principles, and it doesn't look like state socialism. It's an American model, something different under the sun, which I think is slowly emerging, and with intention, political intention, when there's politics, I think we can begin to promote and develop this in the way 14 states are considering state banks, public banks, like the bank in North Dakota. So you see this kind of movement beginning to take these principles to a new level. And again, if you look at it as a historian, the developmental pattern, the next couple decades, not the next election, that's where the groundwork, the foundation potentially gets laid. It's all positive in any case, but potentially developing principles that move to the national level at much larger scale at the right moment.
I was in Argentina in 2001, I think it was. It was right after they had basically told the IMF to take a leap, and months after. And in middle-class neighborhoods, you would see every other house, people had their furniture out in the front yard trying to sell it because, you know, they'd just been devastated. And a lot of the factories were closing. But people continued to show up for work, and they said, damn it, we're taking this factory back.
Right.
And I understand that that has grown tremendously. I haven't been back since then.
Right.
Is that in
the... I think we're going to see some. We saw some of that in Chicago about 3 years ago. There was a takeover.
And the window company.
And they said, we're going to stay, and finally they turned it around.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting about Argentina, now, these are worker-owned companies, many of them now, after the take, it was called, many of them now are connected with the municipal ownership that the city of Buenos Aires provides contracts and procurement and buys from them to help stabilize these companies. Almost something very similar is now happening in Cleveland, where the big hospitals and the big universities are beginning to buy from worker-owned co-ops in that area. So you get a complex that's both worker-owned, but it has a community building idea and linked to something much more stable. And I think that's a really interesting model.
It is. And that way the worker-owned businesses know that they've got customers down the road they can budget out. We'll be back with more conversations with the great minds of Professor Gar Alperovitz in just a moment.